Broadcasting live from our Westlake studios, overlooking the great city of Austin and helping you maneuver through this modern dystopia. It's another episode of Shirts and Skins with Trey and Chad on vacation. Coming up this hour at 12:45, Sam Pica handles the crap bag. At 12:30, we have a big anniversary coming up tomorrow. We'll tell you exactly what. And in mere minutes, it's the Shirts and Skins movie review of Scarface. I'm Trey Elling. Sam Pica is behind the glass. Chad Hastings, yep, still on vacation. In his place for the first hour of today's show is my little friend, Bucky Godbold.
Say hello to my little friend.
Say hello to my little friend. Has that line been said more than, I don't know, any other line in movie history amongst college kids, especially over the last like 20 to 25 years?
I don't think so. When a kid gets drunk, that's generally what he says.
Say hello to my... Hopefully he's not saying it too much like a girl that he's trying to hook up with. That's not a good start for
Probably
him.
Probably not. That's not going to work for him at all.
No, it's not. How you doing today, man?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me in. I appreciate it. And, you know, once again, you know, last time we sat down, we did The Day the Earth Stood Still, one of my favorite movies of all time. That and The Day the Earth Stood Still and, of course, The River of No Return with Marilyn Monroe and Michael Rennie. No, I'm sorry. It's not Robert Mitchum. Michael Rennie is in... The Day the Earth Stood Still.
That's right. He plays the alien.
Yes, Klaatu.
And my kids, my soon-to-be six, soon-to-be four-year-old, still ask me to watch that movie again. Daddy, can we watch the movie with the zombies? Guys, it's an alien. Yes, we will watch it at some point again. Well, Chad is once again off this entire week, his seventh or eighth week of vacation this summer. And fortunately, I have enough nice people around me to help fill those gaps on these weeks where I am sans co-host. Today, that starts with you, Bucky, followed by Jeff Ward joining me in studio from 1 to 2. Had some great conversations with Jeff the last time that I needed to find some folks to help out. And then the third hour starts off with a conversation that I had last week with filmmaker Oliver Stone.
Awesome.
Really good conversation. We talk about a lot from the first 20 years or so from his career, really the first 40 years of his life. He's got a new book out that is a memoir on the first 40 years of his life. Goes through the making of Platoon, and then some of the accolades that he received as a result of that classic film. And it's a great conversation. We talk about the movie career. We talk about his time in Vietnam as a soldier. We also discuss his beloved 49ers. He's a big-time 49ers fan, and people may not realize this as we transition into the review of Scarface. Oliver Stone, one, was the screenwriter of Scarface, and two, he was such a big 49ers fan back then that he named Tony Montana after his favorite quarterback, Joe Montana.
That's awesome. And Brian De Palma, who actually directed the movie along with Oliver Stone's great writing, this was a gem. This really was a gem from start to finish. Back in that day, I mean, I think it was filmed in 80, 83.
It was filmed in, I think, 82, crossing over into 83.
But it was about the 80s and the Colombians and the Cubans heading that way to Miami. And what they did was they captured all of the craziness of what was going on during that time. And that was big-time cocaine. I mean, the Colombian mob, just the overflow of cocaine into the United States was huge at that time. And they captured the violence that went along with it. At that time, that movie was kind of violent to a lot of people. When you left the movie theater after that, you were either in shock, totally in shock of what was going on, or you totally dug what was going on in that movie. You became a Scarface wannabe after that.
Well, I don't want to stomp too much on what Oliver Stone has to say about Scarface, thinking back on that movie all these years later, but he calls this movie an inside the park home run.
Oh, yeah.
Because it really was not well received initially by what he calls the white elite movie-going crowd, those who are looking to just break everything down to ridiculous levels. It didn't fit that criteria back in 1983.
But I bet it fit Miami.
It did, and here's the other thing. Oliver Stone didn't want to write the script initially because this was a remake of a film that was originally made in the 1930s that had to do with Al Capone, whose nickname was Scarface, of course. Oliver Stone was thinking that, look, we've made a lot of Italian mobster movies in the last 5+ years. Obviously, the Godfather films, there were some other things like that. So he passed at first, but when they told him how they wanted to update this idea using what was happening in Cuba, with Cuba sending a lot of people into the States, included a number of hardened criminals. Of course, they mentioned that at the beginning of the movie. And then also everything going on with the drug trade in the early 1980s. Oliver Stone, who himself was dealing with a little bit of a cocaine problem at the time, said, yeah, I'm interested in this now. So he actually moved from Southern California to Miami to do research with his new bride at the time. Her name was Elizabeth. They end up finding Miami is just this mess of a bureaucracy where there is just so much corruption at every single level, from the drug dealers on up to the district attorney and the mayor's office. They end up getting into a little bit of a situation where he's fearful for their lives at one point when they go and do some research in the Bahamas. But ultimately, they move to France. He writes the script, turns the script in, and then, as you said, Brian De Palma really turns it into this almost operatic sort of experience.
Yeah, it was. And some of the great one-liners that came out of that, everybody knows, obviously, Say Hello to My Little Friend, but stuff like Every Dog Has His Day was in it. What do I want out of this world? Everything and everything in it. I mean, stuff like that. There was a lot of one-liners that you just got a hold of, and you just couldn't believe it. And they still stand today all over the place. Tony Montana was a special character in that, and that his love for power was what eventually kind of brought him down. You know what I mean? Between he wanted everything, and he said, yeah, the world and everything in it. Not just I want the world, but he wanted the world and everything in it, including the somebody else's woman, every bit of cocaine there was. He wanted to be the head of everything. He just didn't want to be somebody's guy. He wanted to be the boss. And he grew up wanting to be the boss, and he was strong at it, and he was good at it, as a matter of fact, an incredibly intelligent man. And from young age to when he started to really, really be the head pin. But what takes us down at times is addiction. And that's eventually kind of what took him down.
Well, he broke all the rules that were laid out to him by Frank in the beginning, who was the big drug kingpin in Miami. Of course, Tony ends up taking over and, well, he himself doesn't kill Frank, but he has Frank killed and then kills the FBI agent after that. One of the great things about this movie, and I'm glad we're doing this today with Sam Peake, is because we have three different generations of people who have enjoyed this movie, and you probably saw it in the theater for the first time in the 80s, right?
I did.
So you saw it in the theater. I obviously saw it for the first time as a college kid, and we have somebody who's in his early 20s now who has also seen and enjoys this movie. Sam, when did you see this film for the first time, and what did you love about it the first time through, something that still resonates to this day?
I think when I saw it the first time, I was probably 15 or 16. No, I was 16 because I had just gotten into a car crash the night before, and that was how my parents tried to soothe me. They were like, you know what? We'll watch a good classic movie, so let's watch Scarface.
It could be worse, Sam.
I had my mind blown, though, because at this point, I had already been exposed to the violence and kind of the things that happen in Scarface through like video games and things like that. And so I think, honestly, as a kid, it just left me more in awe. It almost felt more like an action movie than it does now watching it as a kid. Where now it's like I do see the actual, you know, the addiction threads. I see Tony evolving as a human and where he really kind of his whole journey becoming the kind of the monster that he ends up as versus where he starts out.
But he has some light sides to him. The one that brought him down was the fact that, well, not only that, one of the things that brought him down was his weird love for his sister. I mean,
yeah, what's going on there?
He loved her more than he loved Frank's girlfriend or wife, played by Michelle Pfeiffer. It was almost sensual. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Well, that's...
It was...
They do more than hint at that at the end after he has his buddy killed when he realizes that Manny is hooking up with his sister.
Right.
And they essentially kidnap her to take her back to the mansion. And she walks into his gigantic office and makes it seem like she's trying to seduce him before she starts firing shots at his ass.
Did that make you think? I mean, even in the movie theater, and every time I see Scarface or that, some of the parts of that, I was thinking, this is a weird love he's got for his sister. This is not a brother-sister. This was, I don't know. It just was hard. I thought he loved her as much as he did Michelle Pfeiffer, Evira, or whatever her name was in the movie. I felt really compelled to think, something went on here somewhere down the line. And I think they made you want to think that a little bit.
I kind of wish that I had asked Oliver Stone about that. But for me, it feels just more like the lack of some sort of foundation in reality of a psychopath. Because even though he does have a moral compass, he's also somebody who is clearly off his rocker. And he doesn't react proportionally to situations in so many different scenarios. And that is best exemplified with how he looks at his sister. And yes, it's his baby sister. Yes, he wants to look after her. But when baby sister's an adult, most of us understand that we let that individual
grow
make
up
his or her own decisions, and we help them out when they need help. But to see
very
your sister
protector, yeah,
hooking up with the dude at the club, and then they go off to the bathroom together to chief some coke,
yeah,
and maybe make some things happen, for you to break into the bathroom and essentially try to end this dude's life before, fortunately, your henchmen are there to kind of rush him out.
By the way, what a lucky dude he was in that movie. That dude did not get capped, and I was thinking, well, there's one down. When you first saw it, you said, that guy's not making it out of this bathroom.
Oh, it sure didn't seem like it.
No.
And then he shows just how jealous he is of the sister. And maybe this does speak to him having done something with her when they were kids and still having this.
It's hard for me to think that.
Very strange Poseidon love about the whole scenario is that he finds out that his boy Manny, his closest confidant, the guy he can trust more than anybody else on this planet, is with his sister. If there's anybody that is deserving of her,
absolutely,
it's somebody like that. But he also knows that Manny's a dog, too. You remember the scene from the beachside where they're at the swimming pool, and Manny talks about what it takes to actually get a woman.
And goes over to her.
Flicks his tongue like a very creepy snake. Goes up to the girl and ends up getting slapped in the face, calls her a lesbian and whatnot, and Montana is just laughing at him like, you dope, I told you this would happen. He probably assumed that that's what he did with his sister as well. He probably should have had enough respect for Manny to talk to him and realize that this was actually somebody that Manny truly cared about.
This was a gut shot, too, was it not, when Tony Montana kills Manny? I mean, is this
gut
a
shot? And he maybe got him in the chest, too. He shot him two different times, I believe.
Yeah, I think he shoots him a couple times in the main torso area. I just think that ice cream scene, even, too, just, it's funny watching the older movies, because you see, again, even with the scene where Manny goes over to hit on the chick, it's when Tony goes over to talk to the kids, and he's like, hey, watch this guy strike out. That's, again, another thing a parent would never let somebody do nowadays.
Oh, this is a totally different era.
Yeah, some weird stranger walks up to your kids who are literally swimming and
with you, right around you?
Yeah, and you don't say anything. You just smile and, oh, ho, ho, what a goon.
Kids are an interesting theme for Tony Montana throughout. You have that scene where he's clearly comfortable around kids and not threatening in any way, shape, or form. And then he also helps to sway Elvira, the Michelle Pfeiffer character, by talking to her about how he wants to have kids one day, implying that I want to have kids with you. And you can tell their marriage is really in trouble a little bit later on when he's talking about how she's just rotting from the inside and she can't have kids. And then Michelle Pfeiffer fires back in a way that really strikes him at his core by asking him what type of dad he would be, considering some of the business dealings that he's a part of.
For sure.
And then, of course, you have the moment near the end of the movie where Tony pretty much signs his own death warrant by refusing to carry out the plan to have the cat in New York City blown up in his car, because the guy, unbeknownst to them, picks his family up before they're supposed to take that fatal trip. And Tony,
two children in the back seat looking out the window at him in the back window.
He calls that plan off in grand fashion by shooting the Colombian hitman in the head rather than kill the guy that they were there for.
He wouldn't kill the kids. He would have killed the guy.
Well, it's hard when the kids are playing patty cake in the back seat, dude. Just right there
up
in clear view of the back window.
De Palma played that up pretty good, too.
He did.
Yeah, he did.
There were a couple of moments in watching the movie again last night where I realized that it comes really close to a very cheesy level at times. And that is a great example of it right there.
Well,
and actually, Oliver Stone talks about that, how there were times where De Palma was making this, and Oliver Stone's like, maybe we want to be a little bit more subtle here. But De Palma was trying to go overboard with pretty much everything.
Well, in the first time, when you thought that you wanted Frank's girl, his wife, so bad, Michelle Pfeiffer, when he said, the eyes, they never lie, was the one that got me. That was a good one. That was one of those lines that no matter what you do, no matter what you say, no matter what I say to you, no matter how you try to discredit who I am and what I'm all about, when he told her, the eyes, they never lie, she was that got her. That actually was the line that really got her.
It froze her for a second.
It did freeze her. Yes, it did.
So Michelle Pfeiffer is obviously playing a white girl from Baltimore, but pretty much every other one of the main characters in the movie is supposed to be Cuban. There was only one true Cuban member of this cast, and that would have been Manny. It would have been his right-hand man, Stephen Bauer. It was the only Cuban actor. Everybody else was Italian. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, who plays Gina, Tony's sister, she is Italian.
Tony's mama.
Robert Loggia, Frank Lopez. Mom may have been Cuban as well, but between Pacino, Loggia, Frank Lopez, and then his sister, they're all Italian, but that was the era that we were in, too.
I loved the movie. I loved everything about it. I'm not big on too much violence, but I just looked at it as a mob movie more than anything. I didn't look at it as a movie actually about Cubans and Colombians. It was just, in my mind, at that time, in the 80s, it was another sort of mob movie. I think everybody looked at it that way. But if you knew the Miami scene, and it had everything to do, whether it was the dress, whether it was the music, everything about
the excess.
It had a little bit of everything in it, you know, the drinking, the cocaine, everything, all the drugs. It just had that Miami feel to it, as a matter of fact. But in a way, when you viewed it, if you had seen other, no way back from Bogart to everybody, I mean, it had mafia written all over it, some sort of mafia. And it was more like a mob movie to me.
Yeah, there were a couple of moments early on in this film where you realize that Scarface meant business. Scarface the individual, and then Scarface the movie itself. Of course, you had this scene in the what looks like modern Austin, that tent city under highways and whatnot, where they take out the guy who had just gotten there from Cuba to as Tony's first power play. Guy was a sort of intermediary for the Colombians. And then they actually do meet with the Colombians for the first time, and they end up...
he punked Frank's guy.
They end up getting ramrodded because the Colombians are essentially trying to take this money without having to give up the drugs. Unfortunately, Manny is asleep at the wheels. He's hitting on some girl at street level below. Tony has to watch one of his dudes just get cut up by a chainsaw. It nearly happens to him as well, but ultimately Manny snaps out of it, wakes up, realizes something's going on there, and Al Pacino, as a result, Tony Montana just ends up killing this dude in the street. That was not a good look for him. Surprised he did not get busted for that one.
My favorite part of this whole like beginning arc is that, if you remember too, when they're doing the hit on the guy in the Tent City kind of thing, when they're talking about it, they're like, dude, seriously, this is the one thing we do, then we're going straight, we're going to be in America.
Oh, it's all going to be cool.
And then within 5 minutes in the movie, they're slanging coke again. It's all just normal.
Yeah, exactly. Those are some of my favorite scenes. Tony dancing with Elvira in the club for the first time, and her just trying to give him nonstop attitude. By the way, Michelle Pfeiffer, not only beautiful, plays that role perfectly.
And to this day, still beautiful.
To this day, yeah, still. Man. Whoever her surgeon is does a fantastic job.
Maybe not. Maybe that's the natural beauty of Michelle Pfeiffer.
Look, she gets work done, but she gets it done subtly. That's the key with plastic surgery. You can't go fish lips from the get-go. You can't go Meg Ryan. You can't go Jerry Jones. You have to have things happen incrementally. I think Jennifer Aniston has learned that lesson over time as well.
For sure.
So Tony dancing with Elvira, the tongue trick at the pool was hilarious. The assassination attempt at the club. Well, you want to talk about building tension up.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout the that 10 minutes or so, and then it turning into those guys taking shots. They end up clipping the clown who was on stage, who had worked his way into the crowd. Tony getting wounded, but escaping the club while also killing both of those dudes. Then Tony immediately goes and confronts Frank and ends up having Frank killed as a result. You also have the rise to the top montage after Frank gets whacked, where Tony is living this lavish life now, and he's spending money like crazy, buying new clothes, buying new cars, but also getting heavier into that addiction thing that you talked about a little bit earlier.
That was the thing that got him. Now, Tony was crazy before being addicted to cocaine. He was a nut before that.
Mm-hmm.
But the addiction part is what really took him over the top. And was like the ending part of all the cocaine. What it wanted to do, the
mountains of cocaine on his desk.
It wanted to make you seem like that's what really took him down. But he was a sociopath from the beginning. You know what I'm saying? He was never right from the get-go. And there were times when he, as you guys said, Sam, he showed a bunch of passion. At times he showed some unbelievable passion throughout this movie, whether it was kids or individuals. Frank's guy that worked for Frank, who was his bodyguard and took him around all over the place. After he got through icing Frank, he looked over to him and he said, "Hey, you want a job?"
Yeah.
And the dude looked like...
The bodyguard?
Yeah, I'm like... Dude,
sweating bullets.
Oh, takes that big old swig off the bottle.
He's like, yeah.
I think I'll take a job with you, Tony, because I know if I say no, then that's going to be it. But he asked the dude, "Do you want to take a job?" Now, any other person is probably just going to go, "Boom, you got to go too. I don't need any witnesses." But he kept showing this kind of soft side of Tony here and there, you know, throughout mm-hmm. the movie.
Couple quick questions for you guys before we hit some quick internet research and then rate this movie. Is Pacino overdoing Cuban? Is he going a little bit overboard with the classic Al Pacino from the 1990s where he's just kind of screaming too much and just maybe hamming it up just a little bit?
I love the outfits that went along. I needed that lingo to go with the open shirts all the way down.
Okay.
I needed that kind of lingo.
Yeah, to me, it's not him overdoing Cuban. It's just the only way that Pacino could have done Cuban because he's already kind of not an overactor, but he's at like a 10 100% of the time.
Yeah, like Son of a Woman. The same kind of Pacino that you saw in Son of a Woman when he took it to all different levels. And when he did take it to it, it was always at the top level. It was never like in between. It was like always at the top. And in this movie, I thought the same thing.
All right. Rank the ways to die. Ways to die that happened in Scarface from the way you would most like to die to least like to die. Hold on. I've got the three options here.
Okay.
We're only going to top three power rankings. Chainsaw, death by hanging from a helicopter, or getting shot in the gut after hooking up with Tony's sister.
I've never been shot in the gut, but they say that is just awful to be shot in the gut.
But you get to hook up with Tony's sister first.
She is kind of fine.
Is there the best way to go or the worst out of those? Chainsaw, for sure.
Absolutely.
Chainsaw, best or worst?
Worst.
Okay, yeah.
Who the hell wants to be chainsaw?
That one's not going to be good.
Well, too, because they don't do it by like, oh, we cut you in half. They do his arm, and then they do his leg, and then
pieces,
they cut him in
body
half.
Parts.
And yeah, like that's easily the most brutal, right?
Yeah.
I got to go with helicopter, guys.
Really?
I have an irrational fear of helicopters. The technology just doesn't make sense for me. So
so you're already sharding yourself when you're in the copter.
That's exactly it. Although you're right. The pain threshold for the chainsaw would be pretty rotten
as
well.
You drop you out of the copter, your neck snaps, you're gone. There's not much to that.
So how about this internet research before we rank this movie? There's long been a myth that Pacino was actually snorting real cocaine on camera. But everybody says that the cocaine that they used in the movie was actually powdered milk. But whatever it was, it created problems for Pacino's nasal passages. He actually said this in 2015. "For years, I have had things up in there. I don't know what happened to my nose, but it changed after filming Scarface," with all the snorting he had to do.
I hate powdered milk anyway.
That's gross.
You know what I'm saying? I grew up on powdered milk. I went to camp and we had government cheese and powdered milk. At breakfast time, nothing worse. I don't know. Well, maybe pet milk. They used to have a brand called pet milk that we used to have to mix with water to make it look good when I grew up with eight kids. But I don't like powdered milk, so I wouldn't imagine that up my nose. No, thank you.
Just drinking water at that point. All right, guys, 1 to 10 Longhorns for the movie Scarface. Sam, we'll start with you.
I'm going to give it a solid 9. This is probably one of my favorite movies of all time, and it's gave me a motto to live my life by.
One of your favorite movies of all time. Go better than 9, please.
What?
You can go 9 point something if you'd like.
Nothing is perfect. I'll give it a 9.
Okay.
One of those guys. Buck?
I'm going to give it an 8. If I'm thinking that the day the earth stood still and River of No Return, I think we're better. I say Scarface would be around an 8 for me. That's not bad.
Good Lord, guys.
What? It's not one of the best.
Do I really have to be this guy again? Do I really have to be this guy again giving a movie a 10? Do I really have to give it a 10?
No, you don't have to give it a 10. That's why Sam said a 9 and I said an 8.
He said it best himself, Trey. All I have in this world are my word and my balls, and I break them for no man.
Fair enough.
Every dog has his day, Trey. So what do you think? 10? Are you thinking 10 in this movie?
I'm giving it a 10.
That's because
it is that good. It is literally ranked by most people as a top 5 or top 10 movie of all time. If a movie like this doesn't get a 10, then nothing does. And I disagree with you. I think that even with its flaws, there are things that can be considered tens.
You know what? This comes with the fact that Oliver Stone, you got an interview with Oliver Stone. That's all it is.
Well, I tried
That's
to
why
get
you
us,
put a 10
I
on
tried
here.
To get us to review Platoon, but you apparently can't do war movies. So I respect that. So we did Scarface instead.
After, I saw a movie called The Killing Fields or something like that, that was it for me.
Just makes you queasy?
I've never seen Private Ryan, Saving Private Ryan. I've never seen that through.
As Bucky just mentioned, Oliver Stone is joining the show a little bit later on at 2 o'clock. Coming up at 1, it is Jeff Ward. He will be in studio with me for the hour. Up next, though, we need to celebrate an anniversary that's happening tomorrow. We'll share those details with you. This is Shirts and Skins. Chad Hastings on vacation on the Horn. Back here on Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. Chad on vacation, Bucky Godbolt hanging out this hour. Sam Pika is behind the glass, and Tom McKay of Audio Visual Consultations is on the line right now. What's up, Tom?
And you guys are doing movie reviews. I got to get in on that. Come on.
Come on, man.
What do you think of Scarface?
I watch all the movies, all of them. Brian De Palma's a genius. Come on. That's how there is. He's genius. He doesn't have anything below a 7 in his whole catalog, but that's a 10.
A 10?
What else has Brian De Palma done?
Brian De Palma is famous for a billion movies, bud. I'm going to blank on everything. You know that right now.
I'm looking right now. Black Dahlia, Mission to Mars.
There you go.
Snake Eyes, the original Mission Impossible with Cruise, Carlito's Way.
Mission to Mars will be his 7.
Casualties of War with Michael J. Fox, The Untouchables, Scarface. Yeah, you're right. He's got a lot of good ones.
Untouchables was a great
Carrie.
One, too. Carrie, he did that?
He also makes an awesome cameo in this series, Get Shorty, that's taken after the book.
Yeah.
And he makes a great cameo where he just, it's hilarious because nobody knows who he is. He walks in the kitchen and he has to. They all ask, so have you made any movies? And he goes, yeah. And this one lady goes, yeah, just Scarface and Untouchables. And they go, you're that effing Brian De Palma?
You're that guy.
Nobody knows him, but everybody loves his work.
No doubt about it.
Other than giving it a 10.
Kind of like you, Bucky. Nobody knows you, but everybody loves your work.
There's nothing wrong with that. I don't want them to, they don't need to know me. They just need to hear me.
So, Tom, why are you giving Scarface a 10? What do you love about that movie?
It's just... It is as close to what I can imagine. I don't know. I wasn't there. Close as I can imagine, though, to realist. I mean, the way they just kind of cut and clip. And I would have liked it if there was a little more the gore was live. But that's cool because it's neat that you have to imagine the chainsaws going through the bones and stuff like that. It's also one of the first R-rated movies I watched with my kid. Mm. And she thought it was the most cool thing in the history of the world. Just because the whole... fascination with the way that the law is just totally gone in Miami.
Yeah, that was, it was lawlessness there.
Yeah, and just the hypocrisy of the drug war also, especially in that time as it was getting ramped up with Reagan in office.
That's I mean there's very few that you could say are just down, I mean hands down 10. I mean Reservoir Dogs, that's a 10. You know, Pulp Fiction was a 10.
Yes.
Tarantino's good at it, too. But De Palma, he's great at it. I mean, Untouchables was very close.
I did. I liked Untouchables.
Black Dahlia is definitely a 10. I mean, these guys can do, some of them just know how to pick them, too. I mean, it's not like it's just them. I mean, as you've been talking about, you know, I mean, Stone was the screenwriter there. You got to give a lot of the credit to them. And Pacino did a great job. It's probably one of, probably is Pacino's best work. I mean, after the Hoo-Ah became popular, he's gone to nothing. But
you know, he's brought it back in just a little bit recently. I'd say in like the last 5 to 10 years, doing Joe Paterno and a couple of other characters like that, he's returned to that more subdued Al Pacino that so many of us know him from The Godfather. I say so many of us. I didn't see Godfather before a couple years ago. It took me by surprise just how calm he was in that movie. He's kind of started doing that again. Jack Kevorkian.
Yeah, and go back and watch things like Serpico and stuff, and just you go, okay, Pacino was so awesome, and then he just became so big that he didn't even have to try anymore, is what it felt like to me.
Right, he took on too many roles after a while. Yeah. He was trying to take them all on. He's great as a cop. He was always great. Serpico was fantastic. I would give that his performance in that maybe one of the best he's ever done, actually.
I agree, 100%.
Yes.
All right, Tom. Thanks as always for calling in, my man.
Thank you, Tom.
You guys have a great day.
See you, brother. Bye-bye. Be safe.
You too. All right, quick look at the Specs text line before we give mention to the big anniversary coming up tomorrow. Hair of the Dog says, I married a Cuban. Al Pacino definitely did not overdo Cuban.
So okay, that's
take
right.
That, yeah. Take that for what it is. This person says, Oliver Stone is a huge get. He was on the Joe Rogan podcast recently. You're right, he was. And yeah, it's a huge get by me. I'm going to pat myself on the
give
back
give yourself
there.
One for that.
This person says, in college, we played a drinking game called Scarface. While watching the movie, you had to drink every time there was a curse word and take 5 drinks whenever there was an act of violence. Needless to say, you were hammered halfway through the movie. That'll do it. And on that note, we yes. need to make mention of a huge anniversary coming up tomorrow. No, it has nothing to do with sports, but it does have to do with you,
yes, sir.
Godbolt. What is it?
Yeah, it'll be my 20th year of sobriety.
Dude, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Tom McKay, who was just on, knows all about this and what it takes. And tomorrow I celebrate 20 years, and that's a big deal for me. That's one of the bigger things in my life that have gone for 20 years. Every day is one of those days, but when you get to 20... it's something special. Never thought I'd get to this. I never thought I'd get to this. Really did.
Well, congratulations. It's obviously a huge milestone. And was there something, was there either a rock bottom or something that allowed you to flip that switch to no longer feel like you needed to drink anymore? Because you said you have not touched a drink in the last 20 years, which is incredible.
Yeah.
Because just about everybody relapses.
Yeah, probably, I would say probably when I was in... You know, I did go to rehab. I went to La Hacienda Solutions. Thank the folks over there once again for helping me out and understanding that there's you can be at the bottom. I was at LAHA. I went there for 6 weeks outpatient, and I had to be there for five hours every day. I had to be on time. If I missed one day, I had to start this whole treatment over again. So if I went for 4 weeks and I had a day that I couldn't make one of the sessions, I had to start from day one. All over, even if I had gone for 4 weeks or 3 weeks or 10 days or whatever. But I learned an awful lot. I learned there were a bunch of kids in there, and there were a bunch of kids that were, I mean, they were cocaine. They were a little bit of everything. They were addicted to heroin. And the real thing to them was, well, I had to get to the bottom. I had to hit rock bottom. And I just never understood people always talking about hitting rock bottom. Hmm. And... You know, throughout my life, I grew up drinking. I started drinking when I was in high school, obviously through college, as a football coach, straight on through that. And it just happened to me one day. It really did. And, you know, I was starting to lie to family members, just lie about things and where I was and what I was doing. I had to have a drink. I needed to be around alcohol. I mean, my drinking got to a point that anytime I was in my car, and this, I mean, I like to drive, and I always talk about it, I just go for drives. But I had to have a 32-ounce beer in the car every time I was. I would stop off. I didn't even need gas. I just need a 32-ouncer in my car with me, just drinking. And he knows. I mean, I drank. I would do radio shows having 5 shots of Jack and 3 or 4 Bud Chasers before an afternoon, before a show.
You were a regular at... The Yellow Rose,
I was
the Steak and Lobster
place.
Special.
Yeah.
And then you would also kick a couple back, what, at Shoal Creek Saloon, too.
And then I would kick a couple back afterwards at...
Alligator Grill.
Alligator Grill. I was known all over the place, Trudy's and places like that. And it just got to a point where it never affected my work, but I don't know how good my work could have been. So I can never say it never affected my work because I don't know. I don't know how good I could have been, how good a coach I could have been 20-some, you know, 30-some years ago, where I've been if I weren't drinking. I drank the night before games. I got blasted the night before games.
Did you ever drink before games?
No. Not the day of the game, but I was still out that morning before games. So if you want to say the day before games, it was that day.
So you maybe had a little bit of a buzz going in the other direction for the early starts.
I was... You know, it wasn't like I was buzzed. The thrill of getting on a football field just, it sobered you up really, really quick.
Okay.
You know, you had to get to that point of being this, but I had numerous coaches, and like Jack Bignell at Boston College or John McVick would say, did you go out last night? Because I'd be standing beside him, and of course, I was sweating through everything. It was, you know, I was sweating out the booze before. But as I said, as a kid growing up in Pennsylvania, that's what you did. You drank. You're a drinker. Steel mills, shots of Jack Daniels, and I did a lot of shots. I was a shot drinker. Ice was just a waste. You don't waste my liquor with ice. So I drank a lot of straight Jack Daniels, and I could drink a bottle of Jack and not even blink. I mean, it was, you know, you give me a half a day, that bottle would be gone. But one day I just decided, and it wasn't the fact that I was at the bottom. It was just that I was so fed up, and my mother was an alcoholic, and I watched my mother for years. My mother was sober for probably about 30 to 40 years, and she had a relapse. And that's why I always say, if that woman had a relapse, 20 years is nothing, because you can relapse at any given time. So I watched her. As a matter of fact, while I was still drinking, I came to Pennsylvania to take my mom and put her in an institution for a while, into a rehab center, while I was still a drunk. I came to take care of my mother twice. I came once and my ex-wife took care of my mother.
Well, you rationalize with yourself in a moment like that, that you are more functioning than your older parent is.
Dude, when you knew me, I was a functioning alcoholic.
I know.
You couldn't even know.
Well, yes, you were functioning, but sometimes even the best functioning alcoholics come across red dragons.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. I did some kind of crazy things, but when I went to Laha, everything that I took in from there, and every time I got a chance to talk to a young person about, don't let it hit bottom. Because when I quit, I actually quit at a golf course with my buddies, the Texas Cheaters. I told those guys, I said, you know what? I don't want to drink anymore. I don't want to drink, because I tried to stop drinking for a month. I couldn't do it for a month. And then I set it down. I don't want to have a drink for 2 weeks. I can do this. And I couldn't do it for 2 weeks. And then it got to a point, I couldn't do it for a week. I could not have a drink for a week. And that's, to me, when I said, you know what? It's time. It wasn't affecting my work, but I don't know how good my work could have been. So at Clear Channel, I asked them, I just let them know, I'm going to go and you're going to pay for it.
Was this when you and Aaron were still doing the 1-3 shift?
Yes.
Okay.
And
that's what I thought.
Quite frankly, the bosses over there said, you go do what you have to do. We're going to pay for this, and we're going to pay for you to get this done. And we'll foot the bill for it. You just get well. I went for 6 weeks. I came out, and I never give myself credit for it, but the people around me, my Texas Cheaters, the guys that I play golf with, said, "Oh no! When you come back, you're never having a beer. You're never." And one of the first things that first time, because you have relapses, first thing the cart girl came by, it was hot, and I said, "What do you think of just you guys are having?" And they were like, sorry, did you not say you were going to quit? That means you're going to quit forever. And I was thinking, but I could quit tomorrow. I've already been to these things. Can I have a drink now? And it was a no. And my friends, I surrounded myself with friends that said, no, is that what you truly want?
That is so incredibly important, because normally what they tell you in rehab, and you can confirm this, is that you need to get away from the circles that help get you into this predicament.
Mm-hmm.
So to actually have a group of friends that you did drink with but would hold you accountable going forward, that is massive.
Well, because I told them, I truly want to do this. This is not a joke. I'm having some real difficulties quitting. And I knew they enjoyed their beverage, you know, and mm-hmm. some people can drink and do what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Some people actually are social drinkers out there. They really are. There are a bunch of those. And I never make light of it. I never preach to anybody about drinking, but some people can have a drink. I cannot. If I have a drink, I need 6, 7, 8. I need more than that. I don't drink to be social. I drink to get a buzz. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm not drinking to be a part of your group. I'm drinking to get jacked up in some way, shape, or form. That's what made me drink. And so when I quit and time had gone on, and I really never wanted to drink after probably about the first 6 months,
mm-hmm.
it would be like having a bowl of squash. I hate squash, so I didn't want to drink. And then after the first year, I just looked at myself and I said, I will go real drastic. If you ever saw me drink again, you would read about me in the newspaper, because that would be it for me. I would be that guy that would end everything, because I know where it sent me. And then all the damage that it did around me. So that's it. The only reason, if I drink, look in the paper the next day, you're probably going to read about me.
Well, congratulations on 20 years, Bucky, and thank you for sharing all of that.
And thanks to the people around me. Those are the real kind of heroes to where I am right now. They didn't let me go down that path, because they could have easily said, you can have one. You can have one more. You're going to be fine. You know?
It's a snowball effect.
Nah, they said no. You said no. It means no. No means no. So I'm happy with it. I'm excited about it. Alcohol is still a part of my life, as you know. You know, I have things in my life that I'm mentoring a bunch of people. I mentor a bunch of people in this city that people have no clue about.
I think it's healthy not to demonize something that you know you yourself cannot necessarily handle, but realizing that others aren't necessarily in that same boat, too.
No, I think part of it was being a football coach. Part of it was being about discipline and making sure, or being around Tom Coughlin, being there on time, things that stick with you for life. And if you say you're going to do something, do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have enough people in our lives that say one thing, but they really do the other when they're not around you. So I wanted to, this is a promise to myself. This was, you know, after seeing my mother like that, once I went in, I don't want it. I don't ever want it, but I don't demonize that others can do it. I'm happy with people who can drink sociably and get it done.
I think the perfect example of what Bucky's saying is the fact that everything he just said was from beneath a Tito's handmade vodka baseball cap that he is currently wearing.
That's
right
true.
And think about it.
Good relationship with Tito's.
Check this out. I have alcohol all around me in my life right now. I mean, I used to do remotes where there was alcohol. When I was first starting to stop drinking, I was doing remotes and having to go in places where there was alcohol. So that was tough. But now, I mean, I still collect wine for my different wines for my wife. I have Tito's around me, but it doesn't bother me. It's not a part of my life.
All right, guys, we're way late for a commercial break.
Sorry.
Congratulations again, Bucky. You're all good. He is Bucky Godbolt, filling in for Chad Hastings this hour, who is still on vacation. I know, right? Coming up next hour, Jeff Ward is in studio. And at 2 o'clock, it's my conversation with Oliver Stone. This is Shirts and Skins on the Horn. Back here on Shirts and Skins, we're going to make this happen real fast because we're way behind this last segment. So, Sam, go ahead and fire up the crap bag, please.
Chad's crap bag.
Crap bag. If you need an easy way to remember it, just think of a bag of crap.
Crap bag sponsored by Audiovisual Consultations, avconsultations.com, 255-8678. I believe we were playing another game of Am I the A-hole today, correct, Sam?
Absolutely. Since we are going quick, I will get straight into our first and maybe only perspective a-hole, but it goes like this. I bought a house. Previous owner half-jokingly told us at the viewing, "I'm so tired of moving all my stuff. If you buy the house, I'll throw in the lawnmower tractor standing out front." After I bought the house, he told me he'd be fetching it soon, completely forgetting his previous comment. Despite stating that he'd fetch it, the mower stood on my property for 2 years. He also left his shed full of old broken tools and half-empty paint cans and random nonsense all over that he couldn't even be bothered to remove. Suddenly, out of the blue, I get a message saying he's coming to fetch the lawnmower tractor. I reply that unfortunately, due to the time that's passed, I decided that instead of throwing it away, I'd invest money into getting it serviced, the blade refurbished, but still he said he wanted it and he would appreciate if he could come and get it. I said that I would like him to reimburse me a certain amount for my costs. I had also added if it had only been 1 or 2 months, it would not have been a big deal at all, but since it had been 2 years, I felt as though it was mine. He was insulted by this and accused me of tampering with his property and wanted a full itemized billing with reasoning and with reasons for the repairs, and after a few days, he came around when I was at work and took the lawnmower. I'm wondering if I was the a-hole.
No, not at all. The other person is the a-hole for trying to come back and get it after saying that you could have it.
Yeah, just that simple.
Yeah.
By the way, if I had to put anything into it, when that dude would have come to my house, all the parts would have been everywhere. There would have been a wheel over here. The seat of it would have been down the road. I would say, oh, here's your stuff right over here. You can go fetch it.
No question. Yeah, you don't agree to that deal to begin with, but if you do, all of a sudden, everything that he said was yours is yours. He doesn't get to go take backs on that.
Well, too, it was like 2 years that you leave something on somebody else's property.
No
at that
question.
Point.
The amount of time, it's like wishing somebody a happy new year in March or something. The time has passed.
Dude's the a-hole, for sure.
That dude is the a-hole. All right, thank you for an abbreviated version of the crap bag, Sam. Going to push Where We At in Society back to the final segment of today's show. That's because coming up next... Thank you very much, Bucky Godbolt, for hanging out with
Thank
Chad Hastings still on vacation. Coming up next, it is the legendary Jeff Ward here on Shirts and Skins on the Horn.